Was the massive level of deaths attributed to COVID-19 actually the result of systemic medical malfeasance? Was Anthony Fauci giving a pass to his own drug, remdesivir, in spite of the drugs not being proven safe and effective in clinical trials? Were people around the globe subject to a vast state of mass formation leading to totalitarianism? How can ordinary people protect what remains of their freedoms as future pandemics and other threats compel them to embrace censorship of certain ideas in the name of controlling disinformation? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with world tensions frightening us and leading to embrace the pandemic treaty and the Pact for the Future, among other arguably technocratic remedies to the classic Hegelian problem reaction solution, we explore the dynamics of the recent scare known as pandemic, learn from the similar suggested versions in history, and source out ways of preparing ourselves for a possible totalitarian dynamic playing out in the near future. Our first guest, Dr. Brian Artist, talks about his own experiences within the medical care system within the United States and considering a reason other than COVID-19 to the high death toll over the last few years. Then we speak to researcher Matthias Desmet about the psychological state he saw vast sections of the global population subjected to and how it, together with propaganda, linked us to a totalitarian framework for a new technocracy. Finally, the UK former political figure James Ferguson speaks to us about his organization and how it attempts to liberate us from the global allure of giving up our freedoms and being happy. On this week's program, lessons from COVID-19, mass formation, stand for democracy against technocracy. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 13th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Oji-Cree, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Settlers are thankful for the vast assets of this land due to false promises, broken treaties, force, and the doctrine of discovery at the disadvantage of the indigenous people who lived here first, resulting in historic colonialism and genocide. We can balance the scales of injustice through reconciliation and reparations, which include land back, sweat equity, and other measures, if we are to establish respectful partnerships going forward. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Many Arab countries, in my opinion, have learned from the bitter experience of the so-called Arab Spring. They understand perfectly well that the violent overthrow of power often leads to the destabilization of the country and the surrounding region. It is enough to look at Libya, which has not been able to emerge from the crisis since 2011. As for Syria, now the situation there may well follow the Libyan scenario. At the very least, we see that Israel is already expanding the zone of occupied territories at the expense of Syrian lands. That was from an interview with Andriy Antikov under the headline, quote, "Israel is expanding occupied territories at the expense of Syrian lands," unquote. Interview with Andriy Antikov by Andriy Antikov and Stephen Swahini, posted December 11th, originally published on Mideast Discourse. Danielle Smith did not follow through. She's proving to be a major disappointment to many who supported her ascent to power or who even moved to Alberta based on the expectation that the Alberta Premier would continue to give guidance to the movement for medical sanity and ethics. As demonstrated by the content of the following advertisement for COVID-19 clot shots that is published by her own provincial government, Danielle Smith has quietly abandoned the freedom movement that put her in office. Danielle Smith has herself become a promoter and supplier of gene-modifying mRNA biotechnologies. Danielle Smith has become a big part of the problem by showing contempt for the solutions. That comes from the article, The COVID Vax Jab-Pushing Government of Danielle Smith in Alberta, Anthony J. Hall, by Professor Anthony J. Hall, posted December 11th, originally posted on Looking Out at the World from Canada. In the runoff, competing against Georgescu will be the candidate favored by the European Union and NATO, Elena Valerica Lasconi, an outcome where their candidate comes in second is a humiliation for the powers that be. They do not brook their will being challenged because they are accustomed invariably to impose their preferences upon the insouciant and politically naive public. The reason for their present chagrin are therefore understandable. Notwithstanding ringing endorsements, as well as ample financial and media support from the highest places, in the first round, establishment candidate Lasconi trailed by several percentage points political newcomer Georgescu, who was running a shoestring campaign with a skeletal staff. That comes from the article, Good for the Moldovan Goose, Not Good for the Romanian Gander, by Stephen Karganovich, posted December 11th. The foreign-backed terrorist insurgency in Syria has finally accomplished the globalists' objective, regime change in Syria. But how did we get here? Who was behind this decades-long plan for reshaping the Middle East? And what does it mean for the world? Today on the Corbett Report podcast, James dives through the Corbett Report's 13-year archives on the Syrian war to bring these events into focus. That is the introduction to a new film under the headline Video, A Brief History of the War on Syria, James Corbett, by James Corbett, posted December 11th, originally published on the Corbett Report. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. All those people who refuse the vaccine for legitimate reasons or refuse to wear a mask even though it was never satisfactorily proven to protect human health risk being subjected to alienation and even ostracization. This dilemma was one explored by a podcast maker in British Columbia by the name of Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson. In September of this year, Laura Lynn organized a series of speaking events across Canada, reaching out to grassroots people about the forces at large in the global community that has impacted us all. It was called Prepare to Stand, and featured, in addition to herself, three figures making news in the COVID dissenter camp. I went to the event in Winnipeg on the 24th of September to meet with each of the speakers and get insights into each of their perspectives. My first guest, Dr. Brian Artis, is a retired chiropractor, certified acupuncturist and nutritionist, and considered one of the most influential doctors in alternative medicine. Thanks to his new book, Moving Beyond the COVID-19 Lies, Restoring Health and Hope for Humanity, he is now a best-selling author. The book is in its third printing and blows the whistle on decades of what he claims to be deception by the U.S. federal government and how he believes COVID was just the beginning of more planned pandemics. I chatted with Dr. Artist about the incident involving his father-in-law that set him down the path of overcoming COVID deception.
Could you talk about your basically what happened to your father-in-law and how, you know, the things that happened within the hospital that kind of drove you, angry?
Yeah, very good question. Yeah, it made me very angry. So in February of 2020, my 92-year-old father-in-law walked into a hospital complaining of fever and a headache, and within 10 days, he was dead. That was the real story. And in the meantime, he was diagnosed with the flu, pneumonia, acute kidney failure after being admitted. Each of those scenarios were actually published side effects of the drugs they chose to treat him for on day one. And he actually, I had them review with me on day five as he continued to get worse and worse every single day. He actually, by day five, was unconscious and in a coma, and it was induced by the drugs that were shutting down his kidneys. I asked the doctors to show me the medical reports from day one, which would include what's called a pathology test, which is what infections may he have in his blood. So they're looking for every bacterial infection, viral infection, and fungal infection, actually. And he was negative for all infections. But they said to me and to him and to our family that he tested positive for the flu on day one, only to find out he actually never tested positive for the flu on day one, two, three, four, five. They also told us on day two he tested positive for pneumonia. He actually never did.
So there are standard tests to determine what is ailing in your system, and they didn't take any of those tests?
No, they did the tests, and they all came back negative.
Oh, okay, yeah.
They then made up a diagnosis of the flu because they thought it was a... I heard on day five when I said, why did y'all tell us he tested positive for the flu when he didn't? And the medical doctor said, we guess his symptoms said he had the flu, so we just assumed it was a false negative test. And I said, well, I don't care what the result of that test was. If you thought he had a virus, looking at the IV stand, he had a drug called vancomycin on the stand that was pumping into his veins every day since he walked in there. And this made me very upset because vancomycin has published side effects to cause death, to cause acute kidney failure, and to cause rapid pulmonary edema, which is water accumulating in your lungs from your kidneys being shut down by the drug. And that's exactly what was being reported to us as a family one day after another for five straight days before I showed up.
So that means basically there is a place for it, but maybe it should be like as a last resort or something. But it seems like they're using it a little bit more regularly.
Absolutely. Great point. So vancomycin, I asked the medical doctor, why is he on that? Because that's an antibiotic. And antibiotics only treat bacterial infections. So, Reporta, when they said he must have a virus called the flu, why would they pump him full of a drug that doesn't treat viruses? In fact, I looked at the MD and I said, why are you giving him an antibiotic? You know, on the CDC's website right now, it says if someone is diagnosed with a viral infection, giving them antibiotics can make them worse. It is not warranted for viral infections. So I actually demanded that the medical doctors take him off that drug, switch the drugs he was on, and in 4 hours of working with the team and switching the medication protocols on day six, he actually came back to life, lost 20 pounds of water weight, could breathe all on his own, came off of a breathing apparatus within 4 hours. He'd been on for several days, and he came back to life and was conscious for the first day in 48 hours, and we were so thrilled. When we got home, the medical doctors and the administrators of that same hospital had met after hours, and then told the nurse's station to call my wife and tell them I was banned from the hospital and they would never talk to me again because I wasn't a direct descendant of this guy, my father-in-law, and they would only talk to the family members, and if I came back up, they'd kick me out with security. Well, the very next morning, I went up there, and they kicked me out with security and then put him back on the same hospital protocol for the false diagnosis of a flu that they had before I made the adjustments to help save his life. And when the hospital realized that I had actually exposed the liability to the harm they created in him with their hospital protocol that included vancomycin, it was all they were going to do was to make sure that they continued that protocol until the very end so that they could not ever be exposed. So they kicked me out, knowing what I know, and then went back on the original protocol, and within 2 days he was dead.
Didn't you consider taking some kind of a legal action when they followed these procedures? It's demonstrably flawed.
100% I did, except my mother-in-law, who was his wife, absolutely believed everything the medical doctors told them. all of my wife's family, not my wife, but her older brother and older sister, all of them were in support of just listening to the medical doctors, trusting the establishment, and I was the retired chiropractor. So I looked at the family and said, are you going to trust the medical doctors or me, who actually helped bring him back to life yesterday? And they said, we only can trust the medical doctors. We don't have any health professional experience. So I was then kicked out by security.
You know, the guild says this. Okay, that's good. Oh, boy. So this, I guess this caused you to guess go even deeper down this particular rabbit hole and find other sorts of flaws in the system, correct?
Absolutely. But actually, the next 3 months, I was very depressed, very angry. I actually wanted every day I had to talk myself out of not going and hunting down a member of the medical staff's family members and take them out so that those medical doctors, nursing staff, administrators could feel what me and my wife were feeling, because they literally took someone from us who was not ready to die. He would still be here if they would have not continued those drugs that were a part of that protocol. The hospital protocol was my problem. They wouldn't bend off of this protocol, which was actually creating more harm than good, because when we changed it, he recovered within 4 hours. So for me, for the next 3 months, I was very lost. I was actually building out my own case to take legal action and sue the hospital for medical malpractice. This was in February of 2020. For the next 3 months, I'm hearing whispers coming out of New York City that there's this new respiratory virus called COVID-19. And there's this epicenter in New York City that's now it's breached from China and reached American shores. And I decided to go look up what were the medical professionals in press conferences and administrators of hospitals in New York. What were they saying about this COVID-19 infection as they were treating those patients? And what I did was listen to 10 interviews that were only about a minute long on every platform you can think of online. And what every single nurse, medical doctor, and administrator for every hospital said was this: we've never seen a respiratory virus ever do this before. From the moment we start treating COVID-19 sick patients, within 24 to 48 hours, the virus goes from their lungs and shuts down their kidneys, and they're going into acute kidney failure within 24 hours. A large percentage of people. And they said in every single interview, we not only have a shortage of respirators and oxygen providing machines to people, breathing machines, we actually need more dialysis machines for the kidney failure rates that we're seeing. Now, as I watched this, I just had this experience 3 months earlier, and I knew it wasn't the virus they said my father-in-law had that was also a respiratory virus they called the flu.
So you're saying that all of these people seem to envelop the same kinds of symptoms as your father did before this mysterious virus had reached their shores?
Exactly right. So what had happened to my father-in-law is now being reported as occurring to everybody in the COVID-19 hospitals, except what we're watching on the news is body bags being thrown into tractor trailers as if it's just some massive, horrific infection spreading through this area. Well, my problem was is I wanted to know, well, what's the hospital protocol they're using for COVID? Because in my situation for my father-in-law, it was a drug called vancomycin that's published to cause acute kidney failure in 24 hours. And that's exactly what happened to him. So that's why we got him off that drug, only for the hospital to put him back on that drug that led to his demise. So I thought they must be giving every COVID-19 patient vancomycin like they did my father-in-law. So I went to look up what's the hospital protocol. I figured it would be on the CDC's website because it's called the Center for Disease Control. So I figured there's a disease called COVID. Surely they have a hospital protocol. And on their website, they actually stated in May of 2020, we don't have a protocol for treating COVID-19 that is found, that hospital protocol, on the NIH's website. And here's the link. So I clicked it and went to the National Institutes of Health's website, and I read a 3-paragraph memo from a guy named Dr. Anthony Fauci. And what this memo says is there's only one drug that can be used to treat COVID-19 infected Americans, and that drug is not FDA approved. It is an experimental drug called remdesivir. And I'd never heard of this drug, but now I know it's not vancomycin, right? This is all I learned. But there were two studies after Anthony Fauci's quote that remdesivir is safe and effective. He said it, in quotes, he says it was found safe and effective in two trials. A trial in 2019 against Ebola virus, and in 2020, from January to March of 2020, a study done with COVID-19 patients. So I clicked the links to the first study on Ebola in Africa, That lasted a year, that trial. And as I read the paper, it took me about 15 minutes to get through the paper, I realized Anthony Fauci was lying about remdesivir being proven safe and effective against Ebola. Imagine my shock to read that that drug killed more people in that trial than Ebola kills. And it was the only drug that did that out of four experimental drugs. So there are four drugs: remdesivir, ZMAP, MAB114, and a drug called Regeneron. So it was three monoclonal antibodies and one antiviral called remdesivir. Remdesivir killed 53% of all people they gave it to, and it was suspended from the trial 6 months in because it was too deadly and too toxic. And then the authors of the study wrote, "We notified the funders of this study that that drug would no longer continue in this trial. It's killing more Africans than anybody else." So I looked up who funded that study, and imagine my shock to see that it's Dr. Anthony Fauci's department at the NIH. So the year prior, he knew it was the most deadly drug and was found to be the most toxic and deadly, least safe, least effective. But in May of 2020, less than a year later, he's going to say to the world in America that this drug was proven safe and effective against Ebola when it wasn't. Then I went and looked up the second study he quoted from January through March of 2020. That drug trial was for COVID-19 patients. They picked 52 patients from around the world, and that study was sponsored by Gilead, the maker of remdesivir. And what did they publish? 30% of everybody they treated with COVID-19 within 9 days developed acute kidney failure, and 10% of them had to have kidney transplants as a result.
So all of these people essentially died as a result of medical malpractice, where Anthony Fauci's claim that, of his drug being the cure was actually getting a worse result. You're basically alleging that it was iatrogenesis that killed all those people, not the virus, which presently doesn't exist.
100%. And then I found that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which in America is overseeing the insurance for the elderly who are retired over the 60 years old. So it's called CMS.gov. If you go on CMS.gov, starting in May of 2020, our Medicare government agency instilled a 20% add-on bonus for all hospitals if they treated any American older than 60 years old with remdesivir and would tell them that they tested positive for COVID-19. They did not say, "We'll give you 20% add-on bonus if you just use the drug." They said, "We'll give you a 20% add-on bonus for the whole hospital stay for every COVID-19 American older than 6 years old if you'll just pump them full of this deadly drug called remdesivir," which I coined for all audiences around the world to be able to remember when they hear this drug they've never heard of before. I coined the phrase, "Run, death is near." When you hear something that rhymes with "run, death is near," that's the drug I'm talking about. You say no. And so the world needs to know right now that remdesivir is the generic name of the drug. It actually has a brand name, and it's called Veklury, V-E-K-L-U-R-Y. And if you look up the Nordic language, that's an actual word. Do you know what Veklury means historically in the Nordic language? It's a term that means chooser of the slain. Isn't that interesting?
So I guess in about a minute left, I mean, could you just explain how are people supposed to navigate this medical world where you have all of these institutions sort of hobbled by the presence of Anthony Fauci and everything that he's set up? What are we supposed to do? We should just ignore the hospitals altogether and then meet with, you know, a local shaman or something like that? I mean, how can we, you know, care for our, because I mean, medical doctors can do good things, but, you know, how are we supposed to navigate this difficult path?
Yeah, this is great. For all people that are concerned about their health and were afraid during COVID that they might in fact get an infection they're being told they could possibly get, and that their life could be threatened by that infection, every single one of those people from now on, you should know that the only reputable aspect of healthcare, modern day healthcare, is actually trauma and emergency care. So if you've got an injury or an accident or you've had a heart attack, you need to go to the hospital. Outside of that, there is no benefit to medicine. So you do not need a shaman. What you need to start doing is researching on your own how it is that God designed the human body to protect itself from all infections and poisons. And the best way you do that is you start studying how did God design the body, and then start studying herbs, minerals, vitamins. How does that support our entire body? In fact, all of us here in Canada and in America, you've all heard of the periodic table of elements. You all memorized it in science classes and biology, probably. That periodic table of elements, your science teacher would have told you, these are the basic building blocks for your life and every living organism on this planet. You know what's interesting about that list? When you hear the word supplement, what people are talking about are called minerals. And you know what minerals are? All the things you see on the periodic table of elements. So you'll see salt is a mineral, calcium is a mineral, magnesium is a mineral. Did you know that heart attacks and strokes are caused by a magnesium deficiency? Did you know that immune suppression, if you can't fight off infections on your own, is a selenium deficiency? And that's on the periodic table of elements. Do you know what's not on the periodic table of elements? Advil, Tylenol, vaccines, mRNA technology. Those things are not on the periodic table of elements. God designed the human body to fight off infections using minerals. It's designed to heal itself from injury and harm and infections if you just feed the body what it needs. So if you reduce the amount of artificial processed foods that you're consuming, reduce the amount of sugar, which is refined carbohydrates. This is not a joke. I've educated this people for years. The less sugar you put in the body, the boosting of your immune system occurs. Sugar is an immune suppressant. It shuts off your bone marrow's production of all the white blood cells that protect you from every virus, bacteria, fungus, and parasite on Earth. So if you just limit taking in things into your body or on your body or injected into your body that suppress the immune system, your body's adequately equipped to handle any infection. In fact, every cell in your body called T cells, neutrophils, B cells, macrophages, these are your immune cells God put inside of us. They are already known to kill every cancer cell known to man. I actually show audiences, our own cells grab HIV infected cells by the handfuls. They will grab four at once and dissolve all of them and eat them. Your body has this incredible ability to defend itself as long as we get out of our own way. So exercise, getting sunlight, making sure you're sweating three or four times a week, because the skin is the largest detoxing organ of the body. Make sure you're pooping every day. Make sure you're eating every day. And one of the greatest ways to boost the immune system, and most people don't even know this, is to not eat. And that's called intermittent fasting or water fasting. It is already proven you can actually repair any tissue in the human body faster if you stop putting fuel in the body your body has to break down. And then it can reserve all its energy to heal the other tissues in your body.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. It's and then I guess you're going to have a good talk tonight. So I appreciate having this discussion with you.
You're very welcome. God bless you. God bless Canada.
Another person I talked to was James Ferguson. He is from Great Britain, was formerly a UK politician, and he is the founder of Freedom Train International, which is the fastest growing freedom movement in the world. It has an international membership spanning the US, Canada, UK, Australia, New Zealand, and a rapidly developing membership in Europe. I will be speaking to him shortly about how we collectively avoid future attacks on our liberties disguised as meeting the challenge of disinformation and such. But first, we interview Matthias Desmet. Matthias Desmet is a professor of clinical psychology, a psychoanalytic psychotherapist at Ghent University in Belgium, and holds a master's degree in statistics and has published 126 articles in peer-reviewed journals. Professor Desmet began working on his theory of mass formation well before the pandemic began, but during the pandemic, he watched the phenomenon play out in real time, the kind of collective hypnosis that occurs when a population is under certain disconnected, fearful societal conditions. His new book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, lays out what mass formation is, how it develops, how it leads to totalitarianism, and what we must do to change the conditions that makes these mass formation events possible. Matthias Desmet is up next after a brief break.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Matthias, I guess one of the main contributions you have to the, or maybe you've developed a certain amount of status around the idea of probing COVID-19 through the lens of a mass transformation, which has just transformed us. And it's, I guess that's sort of a leading to the path of a totalitarianism or totalitarian state. I'm wondering if you could just maybe briefly outline what exactly is a mass formation.
Thank you for having me on. And a mass formation, well, a mass formation is a specific kind of group formation in which people fanatically start to believe in a certain narrative, which is usually extremely absurd. And such a mass formation can emerge in a spontaneous way, as, for instance, happened during the witch hunts in some of the witch hunts, and it can also be provoked artificially by propaganda, it typically emerges when there is a lot of loneliness in a population and a lot of so-called free floating anxiety, when many people feel anxious without knowing what they feel anxious for. And in that case, if someone distributes a narrative through the mass media, for instance, indicating an object of anxiety, all this free-floating anxiety might at once connect to the object of anxiety, for instance, a virus, the Jews, the aristocracy and the Soviet Union. All this free-floating anxiety might at once connect to the object of anxiety provided in the propaganda narrative, and people might be willing to participate in a strategy to deal with that object of anxiety, for instance, lockdowns to fight the virus, no matter how absurd the strategy actually is. So that's a mass formation. It's a situation in which many people feel lonely and anxious without knowing what they feel anxious for, and suddenly all start to believe that their anxiety has something to do with an object of anxiety that is provided in a propaganda narrative.
I don't know if there's anything, any kind of an analog situation where we're going to, you know, mobilize ourselves that way. I don't know. Is there anything else that you can think of? Or?
Oh, yes. There are many historical examples. Yes, like the way in which in Nazi Germany people started to believe in the racist theories of Adolf Hitler is an example. Hitler, the Nazi regime emerged in a situation where many people felt extremely anxious and disconnected, and suddenly there was a guy who told them, like, look, all our problems actually have to do with the Jews. And the Jews were the object of anxiety, which everyone attached their anxiety. And in this way, there was like an emerging social support to exterminate the Jews. That's one example, but there are so many examples. The witch hunts, the Crusades, and so on. They're all examples of the same mechanism of mass formation. A lot of free-floating anxiety and a narrative that is distributed in public space, which indicates an object of anxiety, and then people start to believe, yes, indeed, our problems have to do with that object of anxiety, and they start to have the feeling then that they fight a heroic collective battle with the ultimate root cause of all evil in the world. Now,
And this has been a part of our makeup since, you know, ancient times. Has it had a tendency to stay stable, or has it accelerated in recent times, or is it decelerated in recent times?
Mass formation exists as long as mankind exists. It has always existed, but the mass formations changed, the nature and the quality of the mass formation changed throughout the last 200 or 300 of years. Like before, let's say, the 19th century, mass formations were usually short-lived. So there were mass formations, but they usually didn't last longer than a few weeks, few months, sometimes a few years, but no longer. And then, starting from the 19th century onwards, the mass formation started to last longer and became bigger. And in the beginning, that had to do with two things. From the 19th century onwards, more and more people started to feel lonely. And like the number of lonely people peaked in 2017, a few years before the corona crisis. The number of lonely people peaked. That means like up to 60% of the world population reported to have no meaningful relationship at all, and to only connect to other people through the internet. So the number of lonely people peaked, and at the same time, the mass media appeared, meaning that these narratives that were indicating an object of anxiety could be disseminated across the population in a very efficient way. And that was when the nature of the mass formation changed. Like the masses before 19th century, the mass formation started, lasted a few weeks, a few months, and then disappeared. But from the 19th century onward, because so many people felt profoundly disconnected and lonely, they very easily fell prey to propaganda that was disseminated through the mass media. And that was the moment where mass formation started to last much, much longer, 10, 20 to 30 years. And at that moment, this mass formation, this fanatical part of the population, 20 to 30% of the population usually, that fanatically believed in these Nazist or communist narratives, segment of the population that was in the grip of this narrative lasted so long that it could become the basis of a new state system. And that was the moment where the first totalitarian states emerged. Totalitarian states did not exist before the 20th century. Before the 20th century, you had classical dictatorships, but that's something completely different than a totalitarian state. In a classical dictatorship, the psychological mechanism of a classical dictatorship is very simple. It's just the population is scared of a dictatorial regime, a small group of people whom they experience as having a huge aggressive potential. And consequently, they accept that this small group of people unilaterally imposes its social contract to the population. But in a totalitarian state, something completely different happens first. In a totalitarian state, first there is a mass formation, meaning first there emerges a group of people who fanatically believes in a certain ideology, and then certain leaders who have certain talents to manipulate that group use that group to rise to power and to establish a new state system. That's what happens in a totalitarian state. And that's what we see happening now. We see exactly the same. A group of people fanatically believes in a technocratic system. They start to believe that the problems of climate change, all kinds of viral infections, and so on, will never be solved by a democratic system. They believe that experts should lead society. That's what technocracy is, a society not led in a democratic way, but led by technical experts. And more people start to believe that. They believe, like, look, the experts know what is best for us. And more there's a certain segment of the population that goes along with these expert narratives and this technocratic system. And in this way, we see the emergence of a new totalitarian system, a technocratic transhumanist totalitarian system.
This whole system came into play, I mean, you argue, during COVID-19. And I guess you could even sort of track a bit of a timeline from the occurrence to it. And then a lot of things that get put into place somewhat deliberately. And all of these things converge to make people really scared. One thing, when people are really scared, they're more inclined to just follow the leader. But I mean, I think that there's even more here than that. And there's this tendency to not only disagree with people who dissent, but to be like violent even. I mean, really, like the whole scapegoat phenomenon. Could you talk a little bit about this scapegoating, which affects all of those who don't necessarily agree with COVID or what have you, and how that helps to factor into the whole, you know, totalitarian makeup?
Yes, I can do that. So, like, a mass formation emerges under very specific conditions. First, many people have to feel lonely, as I just said. And once people feel lonely, they will typically be confronted with lack of meaning making. I could explain that psychologically, but I won't go into detail now. But loneliness leads to lack of meaning making, lack of purpose in life. And once people feel lonely, and struggle with lack of purpose in life, with feelings of lack of meaning making in life, they will typically be confronted with a lot of frustration, aggression, and free-floating anxiety, as I explained. Okay? And then this narrative appears. Someone disseminates this narrative in the mass media, which indicates an object of anxiety, which provides an explanation why people feel anxious. Yeah. And people usually have the feeling, okay, now I know why I feel anxious. There is a virus, or there are dangerous anti-vaxxers, or conspiracy theories, doesn't matter. They feel someone provides an explanation for their anxiety, and all their anxiety attaches to this object of anxiety in the narrative, and then something strange happens. Because so many people at the same time participate in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, people have the feeling that they fight a collective heroic battle and they feel connected again. It is as if the loneliness disappears. Okay, so this mass formation takes away, seemingly, all the problems of people. They feel not lonely anymore. They have a new purpose in life, the heroic battle with the virus. They know now why they feel frustrated, aggressive, and anxious. They can take out all their aggression and frustration on this object of anxiety, so they feel liberated from a lot of psychological tension, friction, and problems. And then that makes people become extremely intolerant for everyone who goes against the narrative.
This includes the really intelligent people.
Oh, yeah, yes, absolutely. The higher the level of education, the more easily people fall prey to mass formation.
Wow.
That was observed already in the 19th century by Gustave Le Bon. That's the higher the level of education, the more conformist people are, and the more easily they buy into narratives that lead to mass formation. Now, so that's the point. People have the feeling, okay, we know what's the problem now. They fight this collective heroic battle, and everyone who disturbs this fanatic belief is considered an enemy and becomes the object of all frustration and anxiety. So the scapegoating mechanism, is something typical for mass formation. It's something that is part of the mass formation, and it's very hard to break through. It's extremely hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems as if getting really intelligent, it's not going to save you from any of these coming threats of technocracy. So, what do you suggest that people should do, or what kind of behaviors they should try to develop to, I guess, fend off this this attack, that this so that they will be less of a less beholden to this mass formation makeup?
I can be very specific about that. You need to speak as sincerely as possible. That means that I could explain it psychologically, but I won't do it now. It leads too far. But usually, when people speak, they try to say these things that society wants to hear. That means they are in the grip of this matrix of social ideal images and all kinds of social norms and rules. Most people, without being really aware of it, never really speak their own words. They constantly try to find out what other people want to hear, and they say exactly this, what is in line with this matrix of social norms and the rules and ideal images. And the best thing you can do to become more resilient against mass formation is to practice the art of sincere speech, to practice the art of truth speech or truth telling. That means when you speak, try not to mind much about what the other wants to hear, but rather connect with what you really feel inside. And if someone is talking about vaccines or lockdowns or deadly viruses or no matter what, first try to feel, but what do I really feel about this topic? Connect with it, and then articulate what you're feeling, no matter what the price is that you will have to pay for it. Just say, no, this is how I feel. And I won't say this because I'm absolutely sure that I know what is true. No, I will just do my best to say what I feel inside. And the more you do that, the more you will feel that you're in connection with yourself, and that you're not so easily misled anymore by what society thinks or what you hear in the mainstream media or on national television. That's the point. Sincerity and love of truth is the remedy for a society which is in the grip of this new kind of lie that we call propaganda.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you very much for having me on. Thanks.
As mentioned earlier, I spoke to Freedom Train International founder James Ferguson. Here's our conversation.
Thank you for being a guest of mine.
Well, thanks very much indeed. I'm delighted to be here. It's my second time to Canada. I was here towards the end of October last year. I flew into Toronto, went up to Ottawa, marched with a lot of the Freedom Convoy movements on Parliament Hill. Christine Anderson was here with me as well. And we met a lot of the leaders of the freedom movement in Canada, Tamara Litch, Chris Barber, Harold Juncker, Eddie Cornell, Veterans for Freedom Canada, Pastor Henry Hildebrandt, you know, some amazing people. And I was asked to come back again this year just now as a guest speaker of Laura Lynn Tyler-Thompson. And we've been on stage now across three provinces, latterly now here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And I'm delighted and really passionate about meeting so many Canadian patriots and those that love freedom. And Freedom Train International is now the fastest growing freedom movement in the world. And
when did it start?
Sure. Well, about 16, 17 months ago, I got active on social media. I'd had a small account when I was the parliamentary candidate with the Brexit Party in the UK at the European level, and then in the general election I was in a target seat in Barnsley East. And myself and my colleague, we actually were very, very serious candidates. We worked very hard. We came out of that in the December of 2019, but in the May of 2019 I'd been asked to create a Twitter channel, and towards the end of the campaign we had about 2,400 followers. Then the pandemic hit, and for a couple of years I hadn't really posted anything. I went back to a farm that I'd purchased about 10 months before, and I was taking a new livestock and building it up, put up new fences. And I decided that I would probably delete the channel because I wasn't using it. And then I got curious, and I went back in to see if anybody was still there, and there was still 1,800 people there. And I changed my mind about deleting it. I spoke to a few people, and the response was instant. Then I got interviewed by other people on other channels, and the channel exploded. Currently, we're approaching 250,000 followers on X, or Twitter as it used to be known. And I decided that there was a lot of people doing a lot of talking, and talking is good, but I felt that there was something that missing. We needed solutions. And I'm very much against the globalist order, those that are using people, that are trying to control people, every aspect of their lives. And I felt the only way that we could actually combat that was to create an international freedom movement, something similar to the Tea Party movement that was created in the United States, you know, 25, 30 years ago. And that's what I did. So I spent 15 months building that up. I was on multiple Zoom calls, 7-8 Zoom calls per day, 7 days a week, across the United States, across Canada and the UK. Then I started to reach out to Australia and New Zealand and then Europe. And our focus now is very much here as I'm part of the freedom movement here in Canada, but also Europe is now our primary focus. So when I go back to London, I'll be back in the Netherlands, probably for the fourth time in as many months. Then I'm heading to do filming in Germany. I'll be speaking to German farmers, those involved with the freedom movement there, and I'll then be flying to Norway for another few days to do the same thing, and then we'll be pulling all the documentary film footage together and releasing that to the general public. So Freedom Train International is offering our members advice and training about how to mitigate whatever is coming in the future. And there are things coming across the horizon that could be, to answer your earlier question, we could be looking at a war with Russia. We could be looking at another pandemic. We could be looking at climate lockdowns. there is a lot more control that the globalists want to exercise upon the nations. And of course, here in Canada, Justin Trudeau is the he's the leader here, but he's also a member of the World Economic Forum, as is his deputy, Chrystia Freeland, who's also a board member of the World Economic Forum as well. So the World Economic Forum, under Klaus Schwab, have, in his own words, penetrated the cabinets of the world. He wasn't joking. He's really done it. And the problem with that is that democracy is dying as a result, and it's created the formation of the uniparty system. So really, no matter who you vote for, you're going to get globalist policies.
Could I just interrupt you there? Sure. I mean, we're talking about, they say you don't know what it's got until it's gone, and so I guess certain freedoms, we miss them when they're gone. And I'm just wondering, especially with you, and I mean, it could be COVID or it could be any of a number of things, but I guess I want to know, maybe was there a particular example, a particularly atrocious example of a loss of rights that really gripped you and anyone else, anyone around you?
Yeah, absolutely. What happened to the Canadian people was completely off the charts. Canada is a beautiful place with beautiful people. They're peaceful, they're polite, they're good people. And what I witnessed in the brutality that was unleashed against those in the Freedom Convoy movement, the truckers, who were not actually violent, they were not causing any issues, they were peaceful, it was good natured. And I saw RMP and other security forces beating down protesters. Now, this happened in the state of Victoria, Australia, under Dan Andrews as well, another World Economic Forum devotee. And there is a clear pattern of behaviour. Jacinda Ardern, the Premier of New Zealand at the time, turned around and said, if you don't hear it from us, if you don't hear your news from us, then discard it. We are your single source of information. If you don't hear it from us, then it's not the truth. That's the kind of dystopian globalist mantra that we are used now to hearing. And of course, in the UK, we now have a Starmer government who is so far involved with the globalists that censorship is now becoming a major threat.
Really? Yeah. I'm going to mention some other things, like the I've noticed that there's been even before Keir Starmer came in, of course, but certain individuals, including journalists, who had been not been towing the party line. I'm thinking about the Ukraine war. Or the Palestine solidarity, people like that were detained in the airport and were really kind of harassed as being the party. I mean, Kit Clarenberg, for example, who I interviewed. So are these also manifestations of what you're saying, and is it connected to this overall, desire to protect freedoms?
It absolutely is. I mean, Freedom Train International is all about freedom of speech, freedom of bodily autonomy. We are against lockdowns. We are against mandates. We are against globalists exercising extreme control methods to subjugate, to instill fear within the populations. And that's how they've been controlling everybody. They've been terrorizing people into believing there was a deadly pandemic there. And of course, we could go into, we won't have time today, but there's so many examples I could give you of that manipulation. Freedom is something that is inherently important to every Canadian. I know that I have many, many friends here in Canada, and I'm so pleased to meet so many of them. They're passionate people, they're good people, and many of them are deeply worried about the direction the country is taking. I've spoken to many Canadians who are looking at fleeing the country. They're looking at leaving Canada to go to somewhere else where they can live in peace and not be under the jackboot of a totalitarian state, which is what Canada is in danger of becoming. And it makes my heart feel painful to hear people say that, because Canada, who would have thought Canada could ever have gone down that route? And, I spoke to pastors, I've spoken to people who are arrested, intimidated, bullied, tortured, put in prison. The Coots Four, for example, they've just been given massive prison sentences. They are actually political prisoners. And, the Canadian people deserve far, far better than that. So do the Brits in the UK. And I'm a Scottish Highlander, but, I am British as well. And what we're witnessing in our own country is deeply concerning too. And I would encourage the Canadians to stand up for their rights, get on board with Freedom Train International. We'll teach you and we'll connect you with patriots all around the world. You're not alone.
Just to maybe push back a little bit on your arguments. I mean, you're broadcasting how we have to protect our freedoms and so on. But the people on the, like, who disagree with you, like, especially you mentioned the Freedom Convoy, for example. A lot of people are saying, well, they have freedom, but their freedom ends where mine begin, and so here all these strangers come into my city and they're taking over. I don't feel free to walk the streets at night, and it's all very, kind of menacing. So how can you, like, are there not limits that you have to place on freedom so it doesn't impact the people around them? Because that's the sort of thing that the people in the Freedom Convoy were talking about. I mean, it's great for some people, but not for other people.
I think the worst that ever happened with the Freedom Convoy when it came into Ottawa was a few noisy honks on the horn. There was no violence. There was no intimidation. There was no arrests made for anything, any kind of assaults. The people were good-natured. They were clearing ice off the streets. They had a carnival atmosphere. And the people who may say, well, they shouldn't exercise their right to speak out or to protest, are in danger of themselves being silenced. Because as soon as you start to take away the people's right to speak freely, then your rights are next. So I will always defend people's rights to speak, even if they don't agree with me. I will always defend their rights to say so. We are living in a totalitarian state where people are being silenced and censored and put in prison because they have different viewpoints and narratives. I mean, it became very evident at the last Davos meeting where their primary focus wasn't on curing world hunger or cancer or making sure there's world peace. No, it was on disinformation and misinformation. And they gave directives to their puppets in the respective parliaments, including here in Canada, to introduce hate speech laws to once again silence, intimidate, and subjugate people from speaking out freely. That will never stand. Human beings need to be free, their spirits need to be free, and they need to have their privacy and their autonomy, including, especially, their bodily autonomy when it comes to medical procedures. And what we saw in the rollout of the mRNA vaccines, I say vaccines with a bit of a concern, because they're not what you would call traditional vaccines. Excess deaths, myocarditis, pericarditis, blood clots, many other ailments. The early onset of cancer is off the charts. And that never happened before the rollout of the vaccines. And I think people need to ask questions as to why there is that what it would appear to be a direct correlation between the vaccine rollout and the increase in people's sickness and ill health.
Okay, so you've already been to, I think, two conferences already in further west. I mean, how do you assess the way people have responded to what you were saying?
I've had a tremendous welcome here. Many people hear my broadcasts. I interview top doctors, scientists, professors, business people, politicians. I've had some very big names on the channel, and I'm followed by very, very famous people. And, of course, our audiences go into the millions. Many of our interviews go viral. So we're well known here in Canada, and Freedom Train, of course, I'm the founder of Freedom Train International. And what we're doing is we're reaching out to people worldwide. I've had a tremendous welcome in Vancouver and, of course, in Calgary as well. It was a fantastic night, very well attended. And I'm very much looking forward to being here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I think this could be even the piece de la resistance, as they say, where we see a lot of people coming in, looking forward to it. And I've been made very welcome here indeed.
That's our show for this week. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation's homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.